ACB Radio Mainstream.
The Cafe.
ACB Radio Treasure Trove.
You can hear
live, unpredictable internet
on the ACB Radio Interactive. ACB Radio Interactive. Playing music from
the 1930s and 40s.
The 50s and 60s.
The 1970s.
80s and 90s.
The hits of the new millennium.
ACB Radio Interactive comes to you from at least 6 time zones on 3 continents, bringing you the very best of
country,
top 40,
classic and modern rock,
new age,
folk,
the rare stuff out of the 50s,
jazz,
easy listening, adult contemporary,
and more.
Live, unpredictable internet radio.
ACB Radio Interactive.
If you're a modem user and you live in the United States, now you can have quality, reliable internet access and support ACB Radio at the same time. Easy Access USA gives you flat rate 56K internet access, 2 email accounts, and Usenet news groups for only $19.95 a month. And every month, $4 of that great price goes to ACB Radio, so we can keep bringing you your favorite shows and expanding our service. So don't delay. Switch today to Easy Access USA. Surf on over now to www.easyaccessusa.net. That's www.easyaccessusa.net. Or if you'd rather sign up over the phone, call them toll-free at 866-835-7872. That's 866-835-7872 between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern. Easy Access USA and ACB Radio, working together to bring you the best.
For the blind, by the blind, ACB Radio.
Hello there, this is Jonathan Mosen welcoming you to Blind Line, the original international talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. And you know, sometime recently we celebrated our second anniversary, 2 years we've been running Blind Line, and somehow it just passed me by. So here we are into our third year of bringing you unbiased, provocative, stimulating internet talk radio. And on the program today, shortly we'll be hearing an interview supplied to us by Jim Layton of the Radio Information Service of Belleville, Illinois, with Curtis Chong, the Director of Technology for the National Federation of the Blind. Jim discusses a wide range of topics with Curtis Chong, and after that we'll be opening up the phone lines, courtesy of spiderphone.com, so that you can have your say either on anything that Curtis Chong mentioned or something else that you might like to raise that's on your mind this week. So without any further ado, let's go to this recording from the Radio Information Service of Belleville, Illinois.
It is time for Talkback, and here's Jim Layton.
Thank you, John. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Talkback on this Wednesday, July the 11th, 2001. We've been hearing a lot in the news these days about the activities of the National Federation of the Blind. In our efforts to give you the listener the latest on what they've been doing, we're joined today from the folks at the National Federation of Blind, their headquarters in Baltimore, Mr. Curtis Chong, the Director of Technology for the NFB. Mr. Chong, thank you so much. Welcome to Talk Back on Radio Information Service.
Wonderful to be here.
Before we get into these issues that I want to talk with you about today, sir, tell us a little bit about Curtis Chong. Who are you? How long have you been with the Federation? How did you become Director of the Federation of Technology?
Well, sir, I have been working as the Director of Technology for the National Federation of the Blind for approximately 4 years. I came in August of 1997. Prior to that, I worked as a systems programmer and a designer consultant for the American Express Corporation. I did that for about 17 years. So a lot of my background is in information technology in corporate America. I came to the Federation as a paid employee in 1997 because I was persuaded that the Federation had great plans for technology, for promoting access for blind people in the area of technology, and I was also beginning to think that technology was going to be either the greatest blessing that blind people ever had or the worst curse that we've ever experienced. And that's why I decided to get out of private industry and come into the nonprofit sector to work for the Federation. Of course, prior to my coming to the Federation as a paid employee, I was a member of the Federation. I've been a member since 1969. And a lot of the stuff that I'm doing now, I used to do for the National Federation of the Blind during my off time, such as it was.
Now, you talked about technology either being a blessing or a curse. I think part of the curse problem is accessible websites. I know the Federation has been doing efforts to make those websites accessible. What have you been doing? Tell us about that.
We've been working with a variety of companies. of course, the most famous case, although it's confused with website access, it does relate to it, is the lawsuit that we filed against America Online. This was back in 1999. The problem with America Online in 1999, which prompted us to file the suit, was first and foremost, you were required to use proprietary software in order to take advantage of their services. And secondly, that software did not work at all well with screen reading programs, magnification systems, speech systems that blind people use to operate computers. Based upon our concern that America Online might become the de facto standard of the industry in terms of accessing the Internet and all of that, we decided it was high time that we first tried negotiation, we tried communicating with Steve Case, we tried alerting officials to the issue. None of that seemed to work at all. And so ultimately we were compelled to file a lawsuit, which, by the way, has now been withdrawn as of a year ago, because we're now in the midst of some pretty hefty discussions. So America Online was one. Intuit, H&R Block, a bunch of these tax preparation websites, we worked very hard with those companies to try to make sure that if a blind person wanted to file taxes online through their websites, they could. We've worked with such shopping sites as The Gap in order to help their website be accessible to screen access technology for the blind. And we continue to work with a growing number of companies, either state agencies or private corporations, to make sure they understand that access to the web for the blind is more than just meeting a set of very specific criteria, such as passing a Bobby test or meeting a bunch of checklist items, but you also have to really run it with a screen reader that somebody knows how to use in order to find out whether the site really works.
A very important issue that took place last month was Section 508. For our listeners who are not familiar with that, what is 508? And if you could, could you clear up some of the confusion? Because there is some confusion about what's covered and what's not covered in 508.
Section 508 is actually a reincarnation of a similar law, Section 508, actually, of the Rehabilitation Act, which is more of a law to try to compel federal agencies to have accessible technology for their employees, and also to ensure that electronic and information technology provided by federal agencies to the public will be accessible. If you're a blind person who wants to work for the federal government, and if you have to use a computer on your job or any other piece of electronic and information technology, for example, a copy machine or a fax machine or a telephone in the office, it would be nice to make sure that the systems that you had to use as a part of your job would work without having you to employ a sighted reader. The biggest complexity, of course, is computer software. We all have to use computers in our job, if for nothing else, to write memos and to do email, and so it is very important to make sure that these software that you have to run will work with your screen reader. So what 508 says essentially is, if you are a federal agency and if you plan to build, use, develop, or maintain electronic and information technology, which is more than computers, it covers a whole lot of stuff in the office, then you must make sure that that technology is accessible. And then to all people with disabilities. And what they also did was they folded some of this stuff into the procurement regulations, so that whenever you are going to let out a contract or whenever you're going to buy some work, you're going to have to make sure that you take a look at the accessibility and make sure that the person you're buying it from will have accessible code, accessible software, or at least compatibility with accessible technology that a person with a disability would use as an add-on to the system. It doesn't mean that every computer in the office is going to have, say, JAWS for Windows or WindowEyes, because, of course, for a sighted person, that doesn't make any sense. What it does mean is that if I walk into a federal agency and I have to use a computer, that I should be able to know that the software on that machine has been vetted to make sure that it will work with access technology. And so the pressure and the onus is specifically on federal agencies to follow this. Now, what the federal government has done initially, and I have to admit they've done it rather well, is to take a good hard look at the websites that they have out now for the public, because that's the first most well-understood technique for making things accessible. And we have the work of the World Wide Web Consortium and a whole bunch of other people to lay out the rules that you have to follow in order to make websites accessible. Plus, you have some very explicit guidelines in the 508 regulations that talk about that. And what happens there is you see this. A lot of websites of the federal government are now being updated as of June 2001. So they're very clearly getting the message that something needs to be done to make sure that most of the stuff that you do on the web will work, if not all of it. And so I've noticed, for example, lots of labeled graphics already happening, and some of the forms have been made a little simpler and that sort of thing. So as I said, the strength of 508, frankly, is the onus is on federal agencies, and the strength of it will come if people choose to file lawsuits or complaints against specific federal agencies whom they feel have violated this law. And like the ADA, we probably will not see any miracles overnight. Nothing is going to change tomorrow, although the fact that a lot of these federal websites have been updated in June, I think, is pretty darn significant.
Isn't there some kind of exceptions for existing websites?
Well, supposedly, they're not going to change. The law doesn't say they have to retrofit their existing websites, but in point of fact, it looks like a lot of them are anyway.
Okay.
So although you know, technically, if you sued a federal agency and said that their stuff wasn't accessible and it was an existing website that was not being changed, that you could technically lose. The point of the matter is that if you go out and look now, try as I might, I have had some different. I can find lots of websites that are awkward to use. I can find lots of websites that take a little bit of training and a little bit of manipulation in order to get the stuff out of them that you want. But it's fairly difficult now to find a totally inaccessible website that you absolutely cannot use.
How is the Federation using online services to help blind people find employment these days?
Well, what the National Federation of the Blind has done is, within the last 3 or 4 years, we developed a system called America's Job Line. Now, let me back up a little bit and say this. We're all, of course, enamored with the Internet, and we all want to have computers that will provide us with access to the Internet. We want to do email and all that kind of stuff. But the plain fact of the matter is that there are a lot of people in this country, whether they're blind or they're sighted, who do not yet have access to the Internet. They don't have computers. Not only that, they probably don't want to learn how to use them. And even though you and I might think that for a person looking for work, the use of the computer is almost indispensable, the fact is there are still lots of jobs out there. I probably have to hunt a little bit for them, but I'm sure they're out there, where you don't necessarily have to use a computer. And even if you did have access to a computer, you'd still need to develop some facility with manipulating the web and your browser and your screen reader. And so you have to be pretty sophisticated in order to use, for example, America's Job Bank, which is a service of the Department of Labor to let you look for jobs. So what the National Federation of the Blind has done is we've developed a system which we call America's Job Line, which is a way of providing a lot of the same information that's in America's Job Bank to people on the phone who can call a number and get the same kind of information over the phone through our Job Line system. And as of the 1st of July, for example, we went and centralized it now so that every state in the country can begin to start accessing Job Line wherever. And that's actually a pretty nifty thing. So that's one thing that we've done to help people get access to online information. We've also developed an article which is posted up on our website at www.nfb.org, which talks about how to make your website accessible to the blind. It's a fairly non-technical article, but it does have pointers to other places that a web developer can go in order to find other resources to help as they begin the quest and the research and the work that's necessary to make websites accessible. And the other thing I think that we're doing that is perhaps more important has to do with the recognition that training to teach a blind person how to use all of this fancy technology is rather difficult to come by, or at the very best, inconsistently provided throughout the country. So in some states you have wonderful services available. You've got agencies for the blind that hire really competent technical specialists and hire enough of them so that everybody can get service. And you have other places where they don't even hire anyone, or if they have hired any technical people, they're either not very competent or they're not as well used as it could be because there's just too many clients and not enough specialists to go around. And so what you have here is a problem where a blind, even for home use, if a blind person goes out and buys a computer from Microsoft, Dell or IBM or Compaq or whatever, you know, it's kind of like putting a component stereo system together. And so we're trying to remedy this problem, number one, by alerting people to the fact that it exists, and number two, by running, we have this thing called the International Braille and Technology Center for the Blind, where we acquire all the speech and braille technology that we can lay our hands on. We get our staff up to speed on all this technology, and then we say to people, call us up with your technical questions, and we will try to point you in the right direction. We'll show you how to get tutorials. We'll tell you which Braille embosser works better than another Braille embosser. And, you know, we buy all the stuff that we have, and therefore no company can say, well, we donated it to you, so you have to say nice things about our product. We don't think that that's right. We feel like we should be able to say whatever we want about somebody's product, and we often do, to the chagrin of many of the software and hardware vendors. So that's what we're doing.
We talked at the top of the show about American Online. Are they any more user-friendly for those of us using screen readers and large text programs like Zoom Text? How have they improved, or have they improved at all?
Well, as a matter of fact, between the time that we filed our lawsuit and the time that AOL 6.0 came out, which was last fall, there already was some incremental signs of progress. There was a time when you installed the AOL software, your screen reader could not even detect things like whether you were an existing AOL customer or a new AOL customer. There was a time when you couldn't even do email without a lot of poking around that was incredibly difficult for some people. And so with the introduction of AOL 6, what America Online did was they, for example, put in a couple of configuration files for JAWS for Windows, which a user can copy, and they have made it so that the email works a little better. They still have a ways to go. But one of the things that they've done, which I think is rather unique, is they've also introduced things like AOL by phone, which is a way to read your email and partake of other services without the use of a computer once you're an AOL member. Of course, you have to pay extra for that. Nothing comes free, you know. This is corporate America, right. You know. But they have made some changes, and as a matter of fact, we had representatives from the America Online speak at our national convention last week in Philadelphia, and everybody was pretty encouraged. We all know we've got a ways to go. We'd like AOL to move very quickly on making things more accessible, but the plain fact of the matter is they got deadlines and all that stuff. And so the odds are they're not going to be as fast about this as we would like, but it's my belief that at least a certain level of the company has gotten the message loud and clear that accessibility is important. They have a small but dedicated group of people working on all of that sort of stuff. And so the real trick is going to be, when push comes to shove, how much top corporate priority will AOL really give to the question of accessibility? Will they, for example, delay the introduction of AOL 7 if they find that there's an accessibility problem? And my hope is, of course, that they will delay it, because it means it will demonstrate that accessibility is as important as other aspects of the AOL service. And so, as I say, we've got progress coming along there, not as quickly as anybody would really like. I'm sure not as quickly as even the AOL people would like, but we have some workarounds that will, in the future, I think, bear some fruit. I mean, you know, for example, today, AOL by phone is a great way to read your email even if you can't reply, and they know that they have to figure out a way to make it more versatile so you can actually send email and stuff over the phone.
Right.
Because not only blind people want to do that, anybody on a cell phone will want to do this who's not near their computer.
You talked about AOL 7 a minute ago. I'm wondering, sir, when the problems we had with AOL 6.0, especially with people trying to use Zoom Text, I heard a lot of problems on email list about that. If 7.0 isn't any better, what kind of action would you be prepared to take, and the Federation would be prepared to take against them?
I'm prepared to say this, that if we find out that AOL isn't, you know, we have this agreement that we engaged in to withdraw our lawsuit for a year.
What I want to know. Would you ever go back with the lawsuit?
The odds are that we would, given the right set of circumstances. Now, I just discovered the other day that AOL people were not aware of Zoom Text and the issues surrounding that, which I was rather surprised about. And therefore, what I would like to do, if I can possibly finagle it, is to get some Zoom Text users to talk to me about what's going on so that I can pass the right information on to the AOL. One of the complaints I already got was Zoom Text Extra doesn't seem to be able to read the text inside of an email message. And so I now have to find out from the people at Zoom Text what exactly is Zoom Text Extra looking for, and then try to get the two people together, AOL and Zoom Text, so that we can make
sure. I know a lot of people on some macular generation list that would love to get a hold of you, sir, because they're having big-time problems.
Well, if they are, we would like to know about it, and so I would not mind giving out my email address to people who want to get in touch with me.
Okay.
At the National Federation of the Blind.
Cchung at nfb.org.
Yeah.
Right.
Cchung, and they can anytime, and then what we'll do is, you know, because I especially need to get some very specific complaints from people about what isn't happening, and, you know, as specific as possible, you know, what doesn't get magnified, what doesn't work properly when you do what you do. I mean, I'm not interested in necessarily a technical explanation, although if somebody has a technical explanation, that'd be absolutely wonderful, but I really have to get some user experiences down so that the AOL people can start really thinking about this as they work on their system. You know, for one thing, they have to form a relationship with AI Squared, right? Because AI Squared developed Zoom Text, and there's got to be a little give and take between the two companies to see what needs to get done.
We talked about cell phones a minute ago. I'd like to talk about what is being done, and I know you're involved with the AOL WGBH with the electronic program guide. Let's talk about that for a minute, and then we'll talk about cell phones. I talked with Leonard Goldberg at the Media Access Project.
Goldberg.
He said that you're involved in that. Could you tell us how, what's going on with EPGA at this point?
Well, here, let me tell you what's happening here on that score. What we have all now had an opportunity to see is a very rudimentary prototype of what you could do if you had speech access to the AOL TV program guide, which, by the way, the user interface is not exactly something that you can slam in there and expect it to work. And so what WGBH did with AOL was to come up with a mock-up piece of software that where you could use your arrow keys and move left and right, up and down through the times and across the channels and through the programs to try to get an idea as to whether or not that was really the interface that blind people would feel comfortable having with respect to accessing the AOL TV program guide. Now, that's only the very first step. If you went out and bought AOL TV today, absolutely not. You would not get this thing installed in AOL TV, and mostly AOL TV would be inaccessible to you as a blind person. So the first step was to get the UI down, and I think we've learned enough now to figure out that the user interface can be done, and we know how to do it now. The next step is to see whether or not AOL is willing or able, technologically speaking, to incorporate speech into the AOL TV box, because without that, you really can't go very far. You're not going to run JAWS for Windows or WindowEdge or Zoom Text on AOL TV, because it's a dedicated machine. It hooks up to your TV set, and what you really have to do is depend on AOL to provide you with the accessibility cues that you need in order to take advantage of it. Now, AOL said that they thought they were going to do this and that ultimately we would see maybe some built-in speech and some other stuff. But then one begins to wonder, because if you look at what AOL TV is all about, what you have there is a system where while you're watching, I don't know why anybody would want to do this, frankly, but while you're watching TV and say you're watching Friends or some other TV show, you could, in theory, pop off a little window on the side of your screen and you could go to the Friends or whatever show you're talking about, chat room in AOL, and talk about the episode with some of your friends while you're on there. Now, you know, maybe I might want to do that, maybe I don't. But the biggest thing I think that we want out of AOL TV, frankly, is the program guide. If we get that much out of it, that will be worth an awful lot, because currently there are no talking program guides that are built into your cable boxes or your satellite receivers or any of that stuff. And so mostly those remain more than a sort of a dream for those of us who want to have independent access to them.
What about cell phones?
Cell phones, yeah, there's a whole... You know, the telephone used to be the device that blind people would love to use, because it was all audio and we could operate all the controls and everything was great, as long as the phone remained a really dumb, passive instrument with a dial and a receiver and a hook, right?
Right.
Now you have the cell phone, which is a computer in its own right, and you have the ability to send and receive calls. You have the ability to look at things like your missed calls log or your received calls log or your sent calls log. You have the ability to learn who's calling you before you answer. All that kind of stuff is built into the cell phone today, but all of that information is visual, and there is no real way for a blind person to get at that information. Yes, we can make calls on a cell phone if we can remember the number we're dialing. Yes, we can answer calls on a cell phone. We can even make multiple calls and do call conference calling or call waiting or the usual stuff. We can figure out how to do all that on most cell phones as long as they have real buttons, although I have seen cell phones that don't have any buttons at all, and those would not be something we would want to buy.
Ouch.
But we cannot yet have access to the caller ID function, even though at home for $25 I can buy, you know, a dumb little box that I hook up to my phone line and it sort of rattles off the number in a monotone voice. You know, we have talking answering machines at home now that we can buy. You know, I've seen them from PhoneMate and I've seen them from GE and stuff like that, but we don't have any of that stuff in
corporate. So how do we make the screen talk?
Well, what ultimately has to happen is the vendors of cell phone technology have to decide to build enough memory and CPU power into the phone that you can install. To me, the most ideal solution would be some form of text-to-speech system, which would allow you then to not only just hear numbers, but also to hear words, so that you could do things like read your call log and hear the name of the person that you want. But that will require more power, I think, than a handheld cell phone has today. Everybody knows that. There are some short-term solutions that the industry could have adopted if it had wanted to, and they are starting to begin to do this. For example, buttons that beep, right? That's very nice to have. Although on one phone that I use, a Nokia telephone, the menus rotate, so like if you push the up arrow key when you reach the top, you have no way that you've all of a sudden reached the bottom.
Know all about that too well.
Yeah, now there are shortcuts and stuff that you can all memorize and write to get to specific menu prompts and all of that, and those kind of sort of work. But in reality, there's always a sense of not really knowing what's happening with your phone. You know, and all that, and some frustration because you know that the phone is a computer, and of course the average person says, why, oh, why didn't they design this thing to talk in the first place? Now, you hear some alliances going on. For example, I heard that one cell phone company was making a deal with some company called Converse, which is a text-to-speech engine company, and some other stuff. And so ultimately, well, and you also hear of some high-end Samsung phones, for example, which will do things like let you program in a number, and then you can say the person's name, and the phone will dial that number for you, you know, little gimmicky things like that. But most of the time, they put the speech in the devices for gimmicky purposes and not for real function in terms of non-visual access. And as long as they do that, then we're going to be at this plateau with respect to cell phones where we can use some of the features, but not all of them. And until they put more memory in and until they make a conscious effort to incorporate some kind of speech into cell phones, which they could even do with judicious use of compressed WAV files if they wanted to. You know, it's just a question of engineering and development and thinking out of the box, recognizing that maybe some of your customers are blind. And I frankly think the cell phone companies do recognize this now, but I think the development cycle, believe it or not, even though we live in this very rapid age of change, people might be interested to know that some of this development stuff can take 2 to 3 years before something that's in the laboratory actually makes it out to the street. And so if they got the message this year that it was important to design for the blind, they probably wouldn't have anything out in the street till 2003.
Let's talk about Freedom Scientific for a minute. Do you have a relationship with them, and what things do you think they've done well, and what things have they made mistakes on?
Freedom Scientific is an interesting company. You know, at one time they were two. They were Enerjoice and they were Blazy Engineering. And both companies had a niche to fill in the marketplace. Enerjoice sold the well-known JAWS for Windows screen reading program, and Blazy Engineering sold the Braille and Speak, the Braille Light, and related products. And most of us were pretty happy as things were. We didn't really think about the idea that those two companies should merge, but capitalism being what it is and the market being what it is, you know, somebody decided that it was great to merge these two companies together, and they did. So now we have Freedom Scientific, which sells a whole series of products. They sell JAWS for Windows. They sell the Braille Light, Braille Speak type note takers, and they also now have pulled in the OpenBook OCR technology. And of course, the very real concern that people have is: okay, now that they're bigger, does that really mean that they're going to get better? Now, we don't really have to know, or rather, we don't really know whether getting bigger has gotten made things better. We do know that with any change, any reorganization, you know, for example, the Blazy division of the company had to close up their Maryland shop and they moved down to Stuart, Florida now. And then you have Freedom Scientific in St. Petersburg, and then you had some folks at Arkenstone over there in California. Clearly, there had to be some knowledge transfer so that Freedom Scientific could provide quality support for all this stuff. And so we've heard, you know, some horror stories about things not being fixed on time, and we've heard stories about people not understanding the quality of the product. But a lot of the stuff we attribute to just normal change, and we figure that that's going to happen. I think we've got to wait another year or two before we really know what's happened, because I've heard both good and bad things about the merger. I've heard people say that their service has not been affected. We continue to see developments in JAWS for Windows coming out. You know, I had a look at a very early beta version for the very next release, and it's clear that they're still thinking up things to add to the product, which is a good thing. OpenBook is probably going to come out with another release in a few months, if they haven't already. And we have already heard the Millennium line of note takers. The Millennium 20 and the Millennium 40 is now shipping, and although there are some things that I could argue that shouldn't have been done to the Millennium in terms of the quality of the Braille display and all that, the fact is they are trying to make some changes, and they are trying to move ahead. And, you know, from where I sit, that's a good thing. Now, there's a lot of rumors going around, none of which have been confirmed, about losing money or people getting very annoyed and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, nobody really knows at this stage what's going to happen. All we know is that we got this company, and that people, my recommendation is that people feel no hesitation in, you know, voicing complaints about products as you see fit. You know, we're fortunate in one respect that they are not a monopoly. If you want an OCR system that's not open book, you can always buy Kurzweil 1000. If you want another program that's not JAWS for Windows, you can buy Windowize or Outspoken for Windows. If you want another note taker, go out and buy the Braille note. You know, so it's not as if they have a captive audience or anything. People can always go off and buy from other companies. And I, for one, hope that that continues. We don't want Freedom Scientific to be the only game in town. We don't want anybody to be the only game in town. We want to be able to have choices, because in the end, the consumers profit from choices, get lower prices and all that. And business can complain all at once about the high cost of doing business. They always complain about the high cost of doing business. They wouldn't be a good business person if they didn't always complain about the high cost of doing business. Whenever you incur another expense, you know, you'd like not to have to do it if you could persuade people that you didn't have to.
Let's talk about Digital Talking Book for a minute or two before we go into some other things. As I see it, there's about two or three different players in this game. First of all, we've got Frank Kurpsilke of the National Library Service, who's dedicated to the computer memory stick and might have something out in 2008. We've got the DAISY Worldwide Consortium with the DAISY software. George Kirscher of Recordings for the Blind and Dyslexic tells us that they'll have a CD product out in October to be played on the FlexTalk or the Victor player. And then there's this little company called Microsoft with their ebook offering. I'm wondering, what is the Federation's view on Digital Talking Book, and which format do you support, sir?
We, of course, worked very hard with the National Library Service and others on the National Information Standards Organization Digital Talking Book standard. We still believe that that standard ultimately has to be the one to which everybody converges. And as a matter of fact, what you are seeing is that RFBND, DAISY, NLS, everybody, they will ultimately converge onto the NISO DTB standard. I think where the differences are is in implementation. RFBND wanted to get a jump on digital books right away, so of course they worked very closely with DAISY so that they could start producing books on CD. From the National Library Service's point of view, I can see why they're very much concerned about using CD as a physical medium. I don't think anybody argues that we're not going to go digital. It's only a question of what medium are we going to use and when are we going to do it. And you know, Silky, believes that they have to do this with great deliberation, and they have to make sure that everything gets taken care of so they don't just abandon all the other stuff. And so, of course, he's got this great master plan in his mind about 7 years more before we ultimately will see the system evolving. I think part of that is somewhat legitimate in the sense that if we really start getting digital books out into the world, the role of the National Library Service for the Blind could conceivably change from what it is today. It could be that, and I'm only speculating, mind you, that I have no information to, you know, support any of this stuff, but it could be that the National Library Service for the Blind becomes an entity which manages to convert already formatted electronic books from the public format into this NISO DTP standard, as opposed to having to produce books from scratch, which is what it's essentially doing today. Now, let me mention very quickly about the Microsoft thing, because I don't want to miss that one. Microsoft, of course, does have its own format. It's called Microsoft Reader format, and what it basically is the open ebook format encapsulated in some very high security digital rights management type layer.
But the first version wasn't accessible.
The current version of Microsoft Reader is definitely not accessible, and they have no plans to make it accessible in the sense of having it work with screen access technology. What they're going to do is they're going to build in their own self-voicing accessibility instead of having screen readers do it. And to some extent, I got to say, I think that's a reasonable approach given the fact that in order for the screen access technology people to play this game, and I'm not against any screen access technology learning how to play the game, there's a whole API layer and a whole security layer that has to be taught and learned by anybody who's going to be a part of this Microsoft Reader environment. You've heard, for example, about the announced partnership between Pulse Data, makers of the Braille Note, and Microsoft, which potentially promises to allow us to read Microsoft Reader books on a Braille Note. That means you have both speech and Braille access to books that you buy electronically from somebody like Barnes & Noble. Now, that's very exciting to me if it really can work. And Microsoft, of course, is banking everything on the fact that electronic books will ultimately be accepted by the public. And Pulse Data is banking everything on the fact that once that happens, then a lot of people will flock to them to buy Braille Notes and all. And, you know, that I regard all of those as different ways to get at books, and my sense is that no one of these is going to triumph over the other to the exclusion of anybody else. What you'll have is some stuff that you can read with the Braille Note or with Microsoft Reader using speech, and ultimately maybe they'll even figure out a way to drive Braille displays if they can do it in their own secure environment. What you'll also have is the National Library Service with its own set of books. Just like today, we have RFBND, we have NLS, we have all these other places where we can get, you know, National Braille Press. You know, we have a variety of places to choose books from, and I still hope that in the future that's what we have, a variety of places to get books from, whether it's Barnes & Noble, whether it's Microsoft, whether it's NLS. You know, we want the NLS standard to survive because we think that that's the way to get all the different players in the field of blindness to cooperate together on one standard. That ultimately will work to our best interest. But that doesn't mean we want to stop the Microsoft Reader project, because we think in the end, if they do their work right, and that's a big if, that means that a mainstream player will be working to make books accessible to the blind, which, by the way, has never really much happened before.
So let's talk for a minute or two about audible traffic signals, and then we'll talk about DBS.
Okay.
What is your own personal opinion, as well as the Federation? And the reason I'm glad you're with us today, sir, is we keep hearing the NFB says this about it, and the NFB says that about it. So we'd kind of like some clarification. Just what is the NFB stand on the subject of audible traffic signals?
The NFB stance with respect to audible traffic signals are that they should be approached on a case-by-case basis, that for a four-way fixed intersection, let me put it this way. Let's start from the beginning. We do not espouse the principle that because we're blind, we require these at every single intersection. So if we start with that very definite statement, that helps you get a feeling for where our slant is. We think that essentially, if you are going to put an accessible pedestrian signal in, that's the new terminology, I guess, called accessible pedestrian signal, that what ought to be done first is to look at the problem that is being created by the particular intersection and try to fix the problem first by varying the regular traffic pattern that created the problem in the first place. And if that doesn't work, then to put in an accessible pedestrian signal. And if you look at our official policy, it says that then, assuming you do put in an accessible pedestrian signal, that the most non-polluting way to put it in without disrupting the environment is using vibro-tactile technology, which vibrates the little arrow on the pole when the walk signal comes on. Now, that is the official Federation position, and I have to say that as a long-standing member of the Federation, I believe for the most part that position is absolutely correct. It was voted on after great discussion among, you know, people tend to think that we're an autocratic outfit, but, you know, thousands of people were at the convention when these resolutions came up, and there was very little, if any, dissent about this particular thing. So our position is, and my position is, vibrotactile on a case-by-case basis, but only as needed and only after fixing the traffic pattern that causes problems for blind pedestrians. Now, I will say this. Traffic engineers like to...
They've got their own language.
Well, they like to pick the easiest solution. They like to come up with something that appears to solve a problem and yet might not. And so what they do is they love these accessible pedestrian signals because to them it's like slap a piece of technology on and our problem with blind pedestrians is over. Okay. You go to them and you say, get rid of right turn on red. Wouldn't that be really cool? Or how about changing the intersection so that you don't have so many wide lanes with turn lanes and islands and stuff? Oh, no, they don't want to do that because the traffic has to move.
A certain direction.
And the traffic has to move.
A certain flow at a certain time. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And the pedestrians just take second fiddle to all of this stuff. Now, there are certain intersections, especially in this day and age where they're becoming more complicated, where we, of course, believe that an accessible pedestrian signal can be of benefit. But we also think that if you approach the question of accessible pedestrian signals with the mythology that they will solve all of your traffic safety problems, not you, but, you know, the worst in general, then we believe that somebody's going to get killed. And that is the worst thing that could possibly happen, is somebody thinking that an intersection is perfectly safe now because they can now hear or feel when the light changes, and then they step out and they forget or they don't learn all the basic skills of travel, which you still, as a blind person, must learn if you're going to travel safely anywhere in this country, whether or not you have an accessible pedestrian signal. I think there's too much mythology associated with this, too much emotional, locking onto one single solution as the answer to the problem, and also the notion they say, oh, we want to make this possible for any blind person to cross, whether or not they have travel training. Well, that's kind of like saying we want to make this intersection safe for any sighted person, whether or not they know how to cross an intersection. All of us as sighted people, in general, in society, learn basic skills of crossing streets. I mean, streets are not safe for pedestrians, no matter how we teach people. If they were, you wouldn't have people killed in automobile accidents, you know? But they are. They're not very safe. And everybody has to develop a certain basic set of skills in order to cross intersections.
Good afternoon. You're on Talk Back.
Is there, that you know of, any kind of federal regulations on those audible signals or not?
Currently, My understanding is that there is a proposal before the Access Board which actually goes counter to what we want. It's only a proposal. It hasn't been adopted by regulation. There is language in the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, which is more a document for engineers, which talks about these devices and essentially says that what the engineers have to do is to look at each of these on a case-by-case basis. But other than that, there are no other. Now, there are some people who maintain that the ADA requires cities to install accessible pedestrian signals, and I believe that's an assertion that will have to be determined by the legal system, because our understanding of the ADA doesn't seem to foster that notion.
The Illinois Department of Transportation that ran that particular light, they had cut it back to the point where not even a sighted person could make it across.
Not even a sighted guide dog instructor could make it across.
Yeah, and so I had a discussion with a guy from IDOT who had a different disability, and he and I started off at the same time, and I was across before he was, and the light had changed on me, and I was still far enough back from the curb that my dog got me safely to the curb, and I said to him, don't you think they should lengthen this light?
Yes. Now, you see, that kind of a solution, I would think, is absolutely marvelous. One thing people have to understand about accessible pedestrian signals is they don't do anything to make the traffic signal longer.
No.
They give you more time to walk. All they do is give you some kind of indication that the walk signal is on, and that's it. They don't make the intersection any safer that way.
Yeah, because we have a really bad area. It's across the highway, and you cannot tell because the cross traffic does not move unless there is enough of a trigger by a car sitting there.
Right.
So if you're standing there, you could wait all day.
I could make a case for an accessible pedestrian signal for something like that.
Yeah.
And I could also then say, but in addition to that, you got to do things like make the cycle longer. Again, that's not an ADA requirement.
Right.
It is a thing. See, if you approach this subject with looking at all the aspects of it,
yeah,
I think that, you know, for one thing, we all want traffic engineers to give a little more to the pedestrian.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those of us who walk absolutely need and want that. And we want them to do that by not just coming up with one and only one solution vis-a-vis an accessible pedestrian signal, but to look at that as one of the mix of possible solutions that are needed to cross and deal with a difficult intersection. And there are a growing number of those, as we all know. Traffic patterns are becoming more complex, especially if you live out in the subs.
Yeah.
And they have those nice, great wide roads where you have lots of traffic going one way but no traffic going the other way. And so if you just pay attention to the cars, you know, I fully understand that what that means is that sometimes you don't think the light is green until 30 seconds into the cycle, and by that time it's too late. You better not go because you'll be killed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where knowing the state of the walk signal is important. And if that's all a person thinks of when looking at APS devices, that's all they do is tell you when the walk signal is on, then that's okay, as long as they know that that's what they do. But if a person thinks, like the engineers will think this, that it solves all of our crossing problems, then we will have lost the battle before we've even begun to fight it.
Descriptive video.
Okay.
And the other reason I have you here, and I'm very grateful you're here today with us, sir, is, once again, we keep hearing what the NFB says on this subject, and I really want to hear once and for all, what is the Federation's stand on this subject? And if you could, give us a little historical overview of how we got to this point with DVS in the first place. But what I want from you, sir, is tell us what exactly NFB is saying on this subject.
We just passed a resolution on this subject last week, as a matter of fact.
All right.
And to summarize, what it basically says, first of all, is that information on television screens, in our view, is more important than entertainment. Let's start with that. The second thing that it says, of course, the Federation really never has, nor does it now, oppose descriptive video, which is the provision of entertainment information on television screens when it's provided in a non-mandatable way.
I was going to ask, so the mandated is the part that you're against.
Right, that is the issue. The issue, you know, the FCC, in its infinite wisdom, could have mandated lots of things with respect to making television-based information accessible to the blind. But what they did was the first thing they decided to approach was the question of entertainment information. And by the way, to be honest, it's only 4 hours a week, which is not very much, of entertainment information. And they only gave a sort of a token nod to the notion of information on the screen, which for many people could be far more dangerous not to know than entertainment. So what, you know, there is technology, for example, that the television producers use. They generate text from a PC and they send it through a thing called a character generator, right, which then puts it up on the screen. Now, we'd like to work with the industry and with the FCC to try to develop a cost-effective way that we can render that same information in an audible way, either through a SAP channel or another channel or some way, so that the blind television watcher can get at the stuff like health and safety information, weather information. So our stance on descriptive video is we think it's great. If the artists want to do it, if the industry wants to do it, let them do it. But we do not believe that it needs to be a government mandate because it sets the wrong precedent. People confuse this with our desire to mandate accessibility to the Internet. You know that, but we those are two different dimensions of access, which one has to be fairly careful in evaluating. In other words, we want access to information. We love to have access to entertainment if we can get it.
Right.
But given what society is capable of doing, I think it's our judgment for the most part that society can't give us the access to entertainment that some of us really want without sacrificing something which we believe would be far more harmful.
You said in a USA Today article of May 23rd that jobs and teaching Braille skills to kids are more important than DVS. Why do you feel that way?
Because if a blind person has a job and literacy and education, they can pay somebody to describe what the heck's going on in a movie. But if they, but if the only thing they concentrate on, you know, it's the old classic bread and circuses thing with the Roman Empire. What do you want to do with your life? I'm not against people watching movies. I'm not against movies being described. I think that's fine. But if we focus all of our energy to get that, then there's no energy left, really, to build up literacy, which is shockingly low in the blind community today in the education system that we have, and to build up, I mean, look at our unemployment rate. We have a 75% unemployment rate of blind people. If you had that within the black community or the Asian community or the, you know, any community in this country except the blind community, you'd have people riding on the streets and stuff. But here you got a 75% unemployment rate, and people sort of take it for, like, that's just the way things are.
But what about the majority of the blind in this country, and we can quibble over statistics, but from what I've seen, a majority of the blind people are senior older blind, and how do they fit into the equation, or do they fit into the equation at all when it comes to DVS?
Well, of course they do. You know, they fit into the equation. They would probably benefit from DVS. But the question is whether or not DVS needs to be mandated. I'm not, as I say, we're not against DVS. We just don't think the government should be sticking its nose into something that's better left to other forces.
But the networks have had years and years and years to do it, and they won't. PBS did, but
yes,
the networks, which certainly would have the money and the expertise to do it,
well, that's right,
they don't do it. So maybe at some point you do have to drag them kicking and screaming.
Well, it's rather interesting because my question would be, where are the millions of letters or phone calls from outraged blind citizenry to the networks to ask them to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk for a minute or two about your court case. As I understand it, the U.S. Appeals Court has lumped the network's case and your case together into one suit. Where are we with the case, and where do you see it happening in the near future?
Let me see. I have to say that since I wasn't involved, I'm a technology guy, so
okay.
I wouldn't be prepared to answer that part.
Fair
of
enough.
It.
What about, and I'm hoping you can help me understand a couple of things here, based on the article I saw in a monitor by Dr. Myler.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really at a loss about this issue concerning infringement upon artistic creativity. Explain it. Can you give us some insight on that?
I think that has to do with the idea that if you are going to provide a verbal description of material, in an ideal world, you would like the artist who created the artwork in the first place, you know, I generalize a lot, of course, to have something to say about how the artwork should be rendered in whatever medium is necessary to convey its meaning to the public. And the way descriptive video works today, you know, the people at WGBH and NCAM, they do their level best to come out with a very good and accurate description of what's going on. But, and sometimes, if they're lucky, they even get to talk with the actual producer so that they can verify with them how they want that to be described. But what if they don't? But they still have to make their best guess at how to describe something. And so, therefore, you already have introduced, you know, because human beings are what they are, there is a certain amount of interpretation and a certain amount of translation that gets involved, and signal-to-noise ratios being what they are statistically speaking. the odds are that there will be some interpretation that WGBH has to introduce into its description. Now, in an ideal world, and I know we don't live in an ideal world, the artist ought to be able to say, this is what I meant to convey, and this is how I want every, you know, how I want this information conveyed, whether it's presented verbally or visually or whatever. And in an ideal world, of course, you'd like the artist to think out of the box in terms of how they present their material so that, in fact, they pay attention to the audio description, that they, you know, it's the same idea we have with regard to development of technology.
But what do you do for the artist when the blind person can't see it in the first place? So isn't some describing giving that blind person some interpretation better than no interpretation?
Oh, look, I don't dispute the need for description. You know, remember that. I think that description is a fine thing. Given an ideal world, the description ought to come from the artist, but if it can't come from the artist, then it ought to come from wherever you can get it. Again, we're back to the whole basic issue, though, of whether or not that description, 4 hours a week, ought to be put into a federal mandate, which is really what the issue is. I mean, you know, heck, I think that we ought to have more programs video described, and I think we ought to do it in a way that allows the blind person to shut it off when they don't want to hear it. Because, frankly, if you've ever rented video movies on tape...
Which I have.
Yeah, you watch it the first time and you get all that description that we want to want to watch it the second or third time. Very often you're tired of it then. You don't want to hear that description anymore.
I know I do. When you talked a minute ago about the FCC and the mandated part of it, and the other thing I had a problem understanding is how is mandated DVS a violation of the First Amendment? Quickly, how is it a First Amendment issue?
I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I think what we're saying essentially is that it forces the originators of material to add stuff to it that they didn't necessarily think to add in the first place.
Okay. I've seen a little bit that on some of the local levels, some of the membership of the Federation has thought about parting ways. Are you concerned? Do you have concerns that you might lose membership nationwide over this issue?
No, and as a matter of fact, I have a lot less concern after our last convention than I did before. I mean, I thought some people didn't understand the issue, but then when it came up at the convention several times, that was not one of our most controversial resolutions, I can tell you. As a matter of fact, it wasn't controversial at all. It got read, it got talked about a little bit, and it got passed. And there we are.
Okay. I asked Charlie Crawford this question. I want to ask it to you. I asked him if he thought this apparent feud between the NFB and the ACB over descriptive video is harming the blindness movement in this country. He thought that there was apparent potential harm. What are your thoughts about that? Do you see problems to the blindness movement because of this battle between the ACB and NFB over DVS?
Well, no. To be honest, I don't really see much of a problem. Really, the blind community is like any other community. You're going to have differing views on subjects, and I think that it's perfectly fine.
So then, when we go to legislatures, we've seen it here in the state of Illinois, when we go to them and ask for things to be passed, they say, well, when you blindness groups can get together and get your act together on these things, then we'll help you. So
they always say that, and you know what that really is? It's a cop-out for not doing anything.
So
they're holding us to a higher standard than they are holding themselves to. And I think that that's, you know, it's like saying you Democrats and Republicans in Congress ought to get together to pass some laws to shape up the country, and when you guys get your act together, maybe the country will really move ahead. Well, you and I know that is never going to happen. You're going to have Democrats, you're going to have Republicans, and you're going to have independents, and God knows what else. And so for people to come to us virtuously and say, you guys in the blind community ought to get together, I'm tired of hearing that.
So what message, then, are we sending to the sighted community out there in this country when we have these kind of battles?
We're sending a message to the community that says blind people know how to hustle and tussle just like the rest of you.
You know, I do see, though, concerns me, and I'm an ACB member, but this whole heating up of the rhetoric from both sides, and Charlie,
Charlie just laid it out,
and now, you know...
That's the point I'm trying to get
to. I read about
here.
The war between the organizations, and one is going to defeat the other one. I'm really concerned as a blind person about the increase in the rhetoric, the anger, the nastiness
that's
going on.
Way.
It's going to destroy us if we're not careful.
Yeah, that's the question I'm trying to get an answer to.
And I would say to membership of both organizations, is this what we want?
Look.
Both sides are throwing mud here, Mr.
Yeah, they really are. They're throwing mud.
I'm not blaming the NFB, and I'm not blaming the ACB. Both sides are at fault here, and the question still remains.
You know, the ACB occupies very little of our attention, to be truthful.
Well, that's fine.
Well, they would say the same thing about you, actually.
They would say the same thing about you.
You know, we've got to stop this.
What I'm trying to get at here, sir, is no matter whose fault it is, we keep seeing, especially in the sighted community, they're looking at us and saying, what are you people doing? So you must have some concern here.
I have enough concern to wish for peace over war.
Yeah.
You know, that is always, you know, wars are costly. You don't want to really engage in them unless you're prepared to win. And any time you win, no matter if you were the winner or you lose anyway, because a war is destructive to both sides. I think that if we had a choice, we would prefer to have peace.
Mm-hmm.
We've always said that.
And as an ACB member, I would say the same thing. I didn't go to convention, but I would say the same thing to our leadership. Come on, guys, cool
yeah.
it. Now, you know, the ACB has new leadership now.
Yes.
Right. And I was going to ask you about that. Do you see Dr. Mahler be willing to sit down with Chris Gray and try to iron out some of these issues, or is it just too late?
Oh, I think Dr. Mahler will be glad to sit down with somebody who is wanting to talk to him in good faith, you know, whether it's Chris Gray or whoever.
Okay.
I don't see Dr. Mahler as being a militant kind of guy in that sense. You know, he's always said it's better to have cooperation and goodwill than to engage in rhetorical stuff. And I think, frankly, the stuff you may have read in the Monitor and some of the other stuff that has come out, I think that is unfortunate that we had to do that. But, you know, as I say, it's a new day now, so, you know, who knows?
Yeah, and again, it's coming from both sides, because Charlie's as bad as
we're not saying the ACB is not at fault, but we're just trying to figure out what it all says to the sighted world out there
us. I will say one thing in our defense, I suppose, if I have to say anything in our defense, and that is that when we took on the descriptive video issue, which appears to have started the thing, we didn't mention the ACB once in any of our position papers about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
You will notice, if you read the ACB's comments, that the National Federation of the Blind gets mentioned frequently.
Mm-hmm.
You will also notice that while we're in the business of conducting a campaign to raise money for our National Research and Training Institute for the Blind, we're not talking about the ACB while we're doing that.
Right.
And yet you have people out there who may or may not be official representatives of the ACB, but who tout themselves as members, coming in and saying, don't give this money to the National Federation of the Blind. Now, there's a long-standing agreement within the World Blind Union, which we're both members of, that member organizations will not attack each other's fundraising.
What do you think that you and your position at Technology and NFB will be working on and maybe in the next year before we say goodbye?
ATMs. We don't want to forget about talking ATMs.
Right.
I think that is one issue that everybody is unanimous about. We're certainly going to keep pressing on web access, and we're also going to look at other consumer electronics.
There you go.
So we can use them.
Now
right.
You're on my subject. consumer products.
That's right.
That's what I was trying to get at with
stereos.
The cell phones. That's it.
Stereos, stoves, televisions.
That's what I want to
Toasters. Talk about.
Microwaves. Cell phones.
You got them.
Hello.
Oh, we got a call?
This is Tony. I wish both organizations would get their heads together, because I, for one, from the very start, I don't know which one to join or to believe in. So with that, I wish you all both adieu, good wishes, and good health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And as a matter of fact, the vast majority of blind people don't belong to either one.
If someone wanted to get a hold of you and talk to you, give us a phone number and an email address, please.
410-659-9314. That's 410-659-9314. And email is, I'll give you the main NFB email address.
Okay.
NFB@nfb.org.
Okay.
NFB@nfb.org.
Mr. Chung, you've been very gracious and answered some very hard questions. We appreciate your candor, sir, and we'll be talking with you in the future.
All right, sir.
Thank you so
much.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye.
That's Curtis Chung, Director of Technology of the National Federation of the Blind. That's our TalkBack program for today. I'm Jim Layton, and this is Radio Information Service.
Indeed, and this is ACB Radio Mainstream. We would like to thank Jim Layton of the Radio Information Service out in Belleville, Illinois, for allowing us to use that interview with Curtis Chung of the National Federation of the Blind. And now it's your chance to have your say. The lines are open courtesy of spiderphone.com, and if you wish to be a part of it, you can give us a call. Our number here is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And courtesy of spiderphone.com, when you're asked to enter a PIN, you should enter 0480-5512. That PIN, 0480-5512. The lines are free. You're welcome to give us a call right now. Often we find that it's first cab off the rank to get things going, and then there's a flood of calls. So if you don't want to wait on the line too long, it's a good idea to get in first. Things we can talk about. Well, obviously you may have some reactions to that interview that Jim Layton provided us with. What's your impressions after that? Do you think that the two organizations are closer together than many people think? I often wonder whether it's human nature that we focus on what divides us rather than what unites us. Do you feel any more optimistic having heard that in fact there is a reasonable
consensus in the blind community, or has that merely reaffirmed your views hearing that? Let's go to a call from area code 920. Hello there.
Hey there, Jonathan.
Hey, that must be Stan.
No, try again.
Oh, I don't know. Is that Michael, is it?
Yeah, Mike Capel. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. I really enjoyed the interview with Curtis Chong. However, I didn't catch... Did he say anything about audible pedestrian signals?
Yes, he talked about those at some length.
Okay. I'm a proud member of the ACB, and the reason is because I like the way that the leadership and stuff is going. And I really feel that NFV really hasn't been that fair as far as that descriptive video service. I did not like the way that he tried to make that distinction between, you know, paying someone to describe it. I think that really should be mandated because we do that for the hearing impaired, you know. We make it closed captioned. That was a law passed in 89 or 88 by President Bush. Why can't we do that for the blind and visually impaired?
What about your response to his argument that it's the wrong sort of thing that's being described, firstly? He's concerned that there's a focus on entertainment instead of information.
Well, I kind of agree with him there. I do feel that information needs to be more described than the entertainment, because, to be honest with you, if it's entertainment, that's just what it is. It's entertainment. It doesn't really have an importance. I mean, sitcoms, those really wouldn't need to be described, because I can get the point just from listening to that. But like entertainment, like if a documentary or like newscast, or like letterless especially, I think those need to be described more.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate your views on that.
Thank you.
Have a good one. That's Michael Capel of Green Bay, Wisconsin. The board's filling up now. We'll just see if we can get to the next call. I'm trying to answer them in the order that they came in. And this one came in next. It's an unidentified caller. Hello there. Welcome to Blind Line.
Hi. Dave in Visalia, California here.
Hello, Dave. Good to hear from you.
Oh, good to hear from you, too. Good to hear the interview. I must admit, it was rather interesting. His take on traffic signals I found fascinating, because I am a bit of a student of not traffic per se, but the automobile industry in general. And what I see happening down the pike, and I think this is, I think in 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a lot less motor vehicle noise on the streets, because these hybrids and sooner or later there's going to be electric vehicles, solo electric vehicles. Right now you got, oh, the Honda Insight is the little one. I think Ford's got one that are hybrids. But the point being that all of the traffic noise that we have depended on over a period of years is rapidly going away. Now, there may be two reasons for this. One, of course, being the lack of the traffic noise itself, and the other being, frankly, those of us that were young and vibrant in the 60s and 70s are, all right, we're getting a little older. Maybe our hearing isn't quite as acute as it once was.
It's all that rock and roll
it's
done.
I have my guide dog, Goliath, as we've walked down the street, has stopped dead in his tracks, will not move a step further, and I'll kind of take a listen, and way off in front of me, I hear this vehicle, or it sounds way off in front of me, it's really not, somebody idling in the street. We need to address those issues, and by, you know, simply ignoring it or saying, gee, you know, let's have right on red go away. Well, it's not going to go away because the populace wants it. Left turn lanes are not going to go away. Traffic circles aren't going to go away. And all of these things are patently and completely ignored by Chong's assertions.
Well, it's an interesting point you make. The other thing I would add to that is that there's a substantial amount of hearing impairment among the congenitally blind. It's not just people like you who've been listening to too much rock and roll in the 60s. There's a lot of people who have congenital blindness conditions who are wearing hearing aids, and if you get into a situation where you're trying to cross a street and you're hearing traffic, that is, as you say, getting quieter, but then you've got wind blowing and hearing aids on top of that, you really are in a very difficult travel situation.
That, of course, brings up yet another situation, and that is, you know, it's got to be, not being hearing impaired myself, but having seen it, that's got to be terrifying to travel in that kind of a condition. And I guess then the whole question, you know, one question leads to another, and that question is, at what point is one not safe to travel on one's own, period? Even it just brings a whole Pandora's box that I don't think we're prepared to get into on an hour-long interview show, unless you want the whole day. And I'm sure there's other people calling, so I'll let that one go and pass it on to someone else.
Good on you. Nice to hear from you, Dave. Thanks.
Nice to hear from you. Take
okay.
Care.
Bye-bye now. Area code 617, welcome to Blind Line.
Good evening, Jonathan. This is Brian calling.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Excellent.
I've had a number of conversations with Curtis over the years, and we find ourselves agreeing on a surprising number of things and disagreeing vehemently on others. And I guess that's the same thing when listening to Curtis in a delayed radio interview.
Mm.
There's three things I'd like to say, if I may. One is on the subject of accessible traffic signals. Curtis suggested that, in fact, those who are supporting audible traffic signals are doing so without, at the same time, being involved in other issues of pedestrian safety. And that is clearly not the case. We, in the American Council of the Blind, have worked for many, many years to try to work with traffic engineers, with the Federal Department of Transportation on a variety of different safety issues. We fought the loss of the implementation of Right on Red when that first came out. In this country, you'd have to redo a third of the nation's highway system in order to change that scenario, and we think it's very unlikely. And if we wait to make those kind of fundamental changes to each intersection, we're going to find ourselves passing the torch on not just to the next generation, but many generations ahead before that's even at all possible.
Actually, you raise an interesting point there, Brian, because it's always struck me that the Federation's view is quite minimalist on modifications. I would have thought that accessible signaling is more minimalist than changing the whole ride on wedge system all over the place.
Yeah, it does have a bit of inconsistency there.
Mm.
But I don't require that everybody be consistent in their views, but I do want to make sure that they state other people's views more accurately. And in this case, stating that ACB or those who are promoting the use of accessible traffic signals are ignoring all the other associated issues with traveling safely is simply not accurate. We work on Right on Red issues. We work on lengthening the time, the interval in which you can cross a street, all of those things. But we'd also acknowledge that in today's complicated intersections, that simply hearing parallel traffic begin is an insufficient means of determining when to cross an intersection. And if you were to interview the vast majority of mobility instructors, they would tell you the same thing. Just go to AER, to the component of that organization that deals with mobility instructors, and they see this growing need for accessible traffic signals.
Excellent.
The second one had to do with DVS, this whole myth that somehow or other it is imposing or that it is a violation of First Amendment rights to require audio description of what Curtis continually refers to as entertainment television, and that somehow or other by supporting description of entertainment television, we're not putting any importance on things such as emergency announcements that are scrolled across the screens so as not to interrupt the audio component of a television program. ACB had on record more than 15 years ago, before there was audio description resolutions indicating that it was our belief that our FCC, Federal Communications Commission, had an obligation to insist that that kind of safety information be made accessible to us. And we continue to consider that an important part of things. But we don't think that that's all there is to television. I keep hearing the words, only entertainment. Only entertainment around the world accounts for a mighty big chunk of the world's economy. Also, there was a couple of statements that I think were just plain misinformed. One is that there was only going to be 4 hours of accessible television. That's not accurate. It's 4 hours per network. And the FCC has ruled that there are, in fact, 5 networks who have a significant enough of the viewing population tuning into them that they would be required to observe this rule. That makes 20 hours a week of audio-described television, not 4 hours, as Curtis indicated.
All right. Before you move on from audio description, how do you respond to the view that you can only put your resources into so many baskets and that while ACB focuses on these DVS issues, it's letting more important issues such as the high unemployment rate go bye-bye?
Well, let's see here. Is ACB doing anything on anything other than audio description, like, say, pedestrian safety, like access to the web, access to appliances, employment, access to transportation? We're working on all of those issues. We don't think one can be worked on to the exclusion of others. And I don't think NFB is focusing all of its attention on just one issue to the exclusion of others. Curtis himself went through a list of the things that NFB is involved with. And I didn't hear him say at all that by doing those, he's limiting his ability to work on one subject because he's taking on a different subject. We think that employment is an important issue, but 50% of the blind population in the United States are 65 years of age and older. So clearly employment is not the only issue we ought to be focusing on. There are issues of employment, but there's also issues of quality of life outside the workplace. And we think we deserve and in fact are obligated to concern ourselves with those values as well.
I was pleased to hear Jim Layton make that point about the senior blind, too, that that they are entitled to some issues being addressed on their behalf.
Certainly.
And you had
Absolutely. You had a third point. And last one, and then I'll let the line go for others. This whole situation where NFB and ACB find themselves disagreeing in public on issues associated with a variety of topics, and doesn't that limit our does it limit our ability to influence people in positions of authority when we don't speak with a united voice? I don't think anybody would disagree that a law that comes before the U.S. Congress that has support of both the Democratic and Republican parties has a much higher probability of being passed. So certainly those issues on which NFB and ACB agree have a much better chance of being adopted or being taken in consideration when formulating the policies and laws of our country. However, it's also true that each entity has to be able to stand up and be counted for issues that it cares deeply about. And if those issues are ones with which the other organization, whether it be NFB about ACB or ACB about NFB, then we do have the right as consumer organizations to take differing views. Curtis suggested that, in fact, there was a long-standing policy within the World Blind Union that no organization who is a member of the World Blind Union in the region would object to the fundraising practices of another organization within the World Blind Union. This is a total fallacy. It is not true. I know where it came from. I disagree. I think it's invented history. I'm a member of the World Blind Union North American Region Board. I'm one of the four individuals who's elected by that body to represent them on the World Board. And I'm here to tell you that during the 12 years that I've been involved with the WBU North American Region, not one time has such a statement been made until the last meeting at which Mr. Maurer objected to ACB and its members objecting to federal and state monies being invested in NFB projects.
I can't possibly see how a policy like that, should it exist, would be workable, because here in New Zealand, for example, our consumer organization has often objected to the fundraising practices of the agency, which at times have been nothing short of patronizing and harmful to blind people, and both organizations are in the World Blind Union. That policy is simply not sustainable.
I think back on
meeting not too well within the past couple of years. The CNI Guide Dog School, with more than 30% of its graduates coming from Canada, opened a Canadian office so that their Canadian graduates who pay $200 for their guide dogs, which is, if you will, the investment one makes in cash into getting a guide dog from the CNI, believing that there's pride in ownership and responsibility in ownership, they wanted to allow their Canadian members or the Canadian graduates to be able to take the purchase of their dog off as a medical expense, as they do here in the United States. But it could not be done unless there was a Canadian branch. So they opened up a Canadian office put together by Canadian graduates, and the NFB objected to that fundraising because it crossed nations' borders. I find that, in fact, the whole issue of who's funding what with what income, and that somehow or other, if they do it, that we're not in a position, or we ought not to feel ourselves to have the right to object to it, is a real fallacy. If my federal tax dollars go to support the National Federation, and I find myself disagreeing with the National Federation, I should have the right to say so. If my state tax dollars in Maryland, state tax dollars are going toward the NFB, and the Maryland affiliate of ACB chose to object to their state tax dollars going to support an NFB structure built on NFB land that would be owned by the National Federation of the Blind, I, as a taxpayer, have a problem with my money being spent to build sports stadiums that are then turned over to team owners. So why wouldn't I object to tax dollars being spent for a building on NFB property to be turned over to the NFB? And ought I to say, well, I simply don't have the right to go and say these kinds of things because it is the National Federation of the Blind? I totally disagree with that.
Well, I
have one more thing to say, Jonathan. I promise I'll say goodbye.
All right.
But I think that there's a lot of concern by the majority of people out there who are not members of either organization, that there's a lot of strong rhetoric going on, anti-NFB and anti-ACB. During the years that I've been in the ACB leadership, I can assure you that if and when it was possible for us to work with the National Federation for the Blind on an as-needed or on an issue-by-issue basis, we have worked with them. I've been on a number of committees with Curtis, for example, where we spoke with a single voice to Microsoft, insisting that they make modifications to their Windows operating system to make it accessible. We have worked together. We will work together. But we do not think that, for the sake of unity, we ought to modify our views to such a degree that we violate the desires and wishes of our membership.
Yes, and that was the point I was making earlier, that there is a lot that goes on where there is compatibility between the two organizations, but you've introduced some great perspectives there, and I appreciate you phoning.
Thank you very much for your time this evening, Jonathan, and keep up the work. Don't stay away from the controversial stuff. It's the stuff worth listening to.
I would never do that, Brian. Thanks very much.
Good night, guys.
Okay, bye-bye now. This is ACB Radio Mainstream, and of course we welcome a Federation perspective on this hour as well. Feel free to phone in if you're an NFB member and you've tuned in because you knew this program was on. You're most welcome. Anyone's welcome to express a view. Our number, area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And courtesy of spiderphone.com, when you're asked for a PIN, it should be 0480-5512. That conference code 0480-5512, area code 541. You have been patient. Thanks for waiting.
Well, you mentioned Stan earlier, so I guess Stan figured he should call in.
This is the man. Nice to hear from you.
It is nice to talk to you. By the way, I enjoyed your coverage of the convention.
Well, thank you.
A few weeks ago. I mean, that was really entertaining and interesting.
Well, I enjoyed it. It was a privilege to be there.
And, of course, some of the things that you were able to profile, including the speech by the president of Freedom Scientific, was quite enlightening.
Well, it sounds like they are finally starting to take advantage of the synergies between their various products, and that there might be a very nice new note taker coming out soon, by the sounds of what you're saying.
That's what I'm hoping for. And by the way, and I really like the idea that you have the program following, I mean, before this one, I mean, as a part of Blindline, where you had the speaker Curtis Chung. Whether you did, whether you agree with the individual or disagree, it was very refreshing to see the kind of things where views were able to be expressed.
Well, ACB Radio has called itself the voice of the world's blind community, and that's not just rhetoric. We've always been open, as you may well know. We've invited Mark Mara on this program, and so when we were offered the opportunity to get this recorded interview, it was wonderful to be able to, expose people to the Federation perspective, which is what we've always wanted to do on this show.
Because I think the thing is, and I do believe that there is a perception by some people that the very fact that there isn't agreement among the blind organizations in some areas, that it almost means that blind people do not have a cohesive voice. But I really do think that you need to have differences and be able to express them. And I think it's like one choice is no choice at all. You just have to have this kind of thing where people were able to go out there and, you know, go through the mud, so to speak, and get your views out there. Because it's important, because that's where, through rational discussion of issues, we can all learn something. And, of course, and I think most blind people, all blind people, I would say, at least most want to have things, for example, especially the area of, you know, appliances and whether it's internet access or accessible software. We want to have these kinds of things.
Well, yeah, I find it interesting, though, Stan, because I'm looking at this from an international perspective, I suppose. I know no other blindness organization that takes the same view on audible pedestrian signaling as the Federation. It seems to be isolated the world over on a subject like that. I'm also curious, really, and that's why I somewhat regret that I haven't had the chance to have someone from NFB on the program of late, because what I'd like to ask them is, if we're talking about getting the 75% unemployment rate down, and everybody wants that to happen, so that, in Curtis Chong's word, you could employ a reader to tell you what's on the TV, why don't you also apply that same logic to the internet and to automatic teller machines? I mean, the NFB
exactly
seems to be inconsistent.
The thing that I'm wondering about, too, when you talk about the internet, and of course, when you talk about broadcasting, the airwaves are supposed to belong to the public. Now, last time I checked, the blind people are part of the public.
Yes.
And I think that these things have to be addressed, and we won't speculate on why the AOL suit was dropped, because I kind of have a funny feeling there, but I'm not going to go there. But it's kind of interesting. I think we do have to kind of step back and examine things, and sometimes it's always good to examine motives for things, too, because there's no one that, you know, is that has a clear answer to everything, and hopefully we can all learn from that.
Well, that's true.
What concerns me, too, is, you know, we're talking about accessibility, and the reason I thought about it, well, an individual contacted me recently and asked me which ISP I used, and they were talking about using AOL, they heard it wasn't accessible. I said, well, and I gave my opinion about which ISP they should use and so on and so forth. But the thing of the matter is, I think just because the suit has been dropped doesn't mean that people shouldn't put pressure on AOL to kind of help make things more accessible, especially with their membership going up so much. I mean, they can afford to kind of think about these issues. Not that you want to always legislate the matter with a lawsuit, because I don't think that's helpful, but because it takes resources they could otherwise use for making things accessible. But I think you do have to find ways to at least put pressure on entities to make sure they keep the job up.
Yeah. You know, there are so many things that came out of that interview. I think one of the things that interested me was the comment from Curtis that the ACB, when it makes comment on things like audible description, often mentions NFB specifically, but that the NFB in its original filings didn't mention ACB, and I guess he was making the point that ACB is a bit confrontational, that NFB feels a bit picked on. It seems to me interesting, though, that the NFB has actually taken a stance which is seeking to destroy, if that's not too emotive a term, an outcome for which a group of blind people have worked hard over a period of some years, and that's the audible description federal mandating. I think that's the difference. I think that when another blindness consumer organisation doesn't say, well, we don't necessarily think this is a great idea, but we'll just sit back, we won't encourage it, we won't discourage it, but they actually actively come in and seek to upset the apple cart, I think that it's inevitable that there will be some reaction to that from the affected, aggrieved organisation.
Oh, sure, and there should be, because people shouldn't just sit back and say, you know, yes, sir, we don't agree with you, but we'll sit back, because that isn't doing any service or any good to the blind consumer, whatever they're, whatever they're consuming, whatever their product is, whatever they're an active consumer for, is what I should be saying. Because, I mean, you could make the argument that, you know, with AOL and everything like that, if you're talking about the lawsuit sort of thing, you can make the argument as whether blind people are mandating something that maybe they shouldn't have a need for mandating. In other words, we throw out the term mandating, whether it's government or whatever, yet we don't think of how that could be perceived by others. Now, I think AOL should be accessible? Of course. There's no question, for example. But I think, in other words, when you talk about one group talking about mandating by government, and you talk about another group mandating by a big stick, some people may not perceive much difference in the two things. Now, I'm a staunch supporter of web access for the blind, as you know. I mean, I'm listening to your program every week, or at least every week that I can, for example, and Main Menu and a lot of other things. But I think sometimes there's an inconsistency there with organizations. I mean, I think it was Dave earlier was talking about the hearing impaired and getting having the use mandated for the services that they have. And of course, you know, in the United States, even telephone users have, you know, TTY and other kinds of services that are mandated. Why should we have it any different? Why shouldn't we have certain things that are mandated, as long as they can be put into some sort of workable form? Something to think about.
I appreciate your perspective, and nice to hear from you again.
Talk to you later.
Okay, Stan. Bye-bye now. And if you've been wanting to give us a call, well, the board is starting to empty just a little, so you won't have too much of a wait if you give us a call right now. If you'd like to share your perspective, if you disagree with what you've heard so far today, area code 212-812-2800. It's an open forum, and you're all welcome. Area code 212-812-2800. And then the conference code 0480-5512, courtesy of spiderphone.com. 0480-5512. Let's go to Nick. Hello there.
And I must say that you mentioned disagree. I have to.
Go ahead.
I heard about the Seeing Eye thing. Now, I know somebody who actually went to Seeing Eye, and I know about the Canadian Institute thing. Now, why should NFB have to go through and go and, I don't know the word, but do something to a stop a Canadian service that has been put on by Canadians as a result of Seeing Eye? Isn't Seeing Eye their own organization?
Yes, I'm not sure if you're saying that you oppose NFB seeking to prevent that Canadian arm of Seeing Eye from being established?
Yes.
Right, okay.
I completely disagree with that. That is something for the CNIB to take into account.
Well, even is it? I mean, the CNIB is an agency. I would imagine there's a conflict of interest, perhaps, potentially, in CNIB having a view on that. But certainly one could argue that NFB not being a Canadian organization may not be wanting to have a view either.
You're right. It's very, I mean, Canadian organization should have a view. If I have to say, because I mean, it's a service for the blind in their own country. We should not have anything to do with anything that goes on in Canada.
Okay. And did you have any other comments?
Yes, and another thing. Why should one go out there and oppose audio pedestrian signals? And unfortunately, I am familiar with somebody who does. I'm right now going through, like, whenever I have to cross the street, they're telling me that audio pedestrian signals will not be, is not what you're looking for. You're supposed to listen to, for, parallel and perpendicular traffic, and if one is X, if XXSX is this and XXX is that, you do XXX. And, I mean, the parallel and perpendicular thing, especially here on Long Island where I live, has been being very active. I mean, it's one of the things that you, that I've seen more along the lines in people who are, well, a lot of mobility instructors perhaps, like my own, are for that. They're not really big on the accessible pedestrian.
Yeah, I think that probably varies depending on the instructor and their philosophical belief system. But I suppose the argument could be made that it's a use-it-or-lose-it thing. I remember that a few years ago, before computers, I could remember copious amounts of telephone numbers and probably do some pretty reasonable calculations in my head. And these days, I reach for the Braille note or and its calculator and its phone directory quite regularly, simply because I've not kept up that skill of remembering things. Is it possible that audio pedestrian signaling may make us go soft?
Yeah, that's right. It's possible. By the way, I was asked to ask one question when I could get to it. What's super blind?
That's something that's come up on a number of occasions on various ACB radio programs, and I don't know whether we've ever had a definition that stuck. I suppose a super blind is somebody who does not conform to whoever is using the term's definition or preconditioning about what a blind person should be and how they should behave and what kind of work they should do.
Okay. Well, I've got to go.
Me too. Have a good one. That was Nick calling from Long Island, and we actually now have a free board of calls, which is quite unusual for this time during the program. So if you'd like to get in touch with us and you phone now, you will get straight on the internet wireless. How about that? The number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And you'll be asked by spiderphone.com for a conference code, and that is 0480-55-12, courtesy of spiderphone.com. That conference code again is 0480-55-12. And if you've joined us late, we played earlier an interview with Curtis Chong of the National Federation of the Blind from Jim Layton of the Radio Information Service in Belleville, Illinois, and we're currently fielding calls on that interview. What did you think of it? Do you think that the organizations are perhaps not as far apart as you originally thought? You may have heard some discussion there about technology issues that concern all of us, and I'm sure that there's unanimity on some of those issues, but inevitably there was discussion about some of those issues where there is not that kind of consensus, and those issues include audible pedestrian signalling and audio description that is federally mandated. I think it's important that we make that distinction, so we welcome your thoughts on that. And somebody who has phoned us is from area code 812. Hello there.
Hello, this is Michael Loft. How are you doing, Jonathan?
Oh, very well, and you?
Not too bad. Always glad to help there, promoting dialogue.
Yeah, and, excellent. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's good to let folks hear both sides. We need to get an idea of the mix. One couple thoughts, but one on DBS, to go the other extreme. are we ready, people who do talk shows or encode programs for other people or will do talk shows in the future, are we ready to have a mandate that we type every word of everything that's said?
You know, that is something that has really concerned me, because there have been a couple of instances, particularly with Blazy products, which have quite a following in the deaf-blind community, where I've posted email messages to lists saying that we're going to be doing a review of such and such a product, and people have said, can we get a transcript? And at the moment, you can't do that electronically. You'd have to sit there and physically type it out, and it's a time thing. And I am concerned about that. I know that WGBH have tried to provide tools that make that a little easier.
Yeah, they're definitely working on some tools, and it's amazing that with all the corporate money, they have to get donations to do that very useful, valuable work.
Yeah, they do a fine job there. But it's interesting. Have you attempted to do that with anything you've done streaming wise? Try to put a transcript together?
No, I haven't. I could certainly type out the text and give me a good spell checker, but.
You know, one of the things that's really getting quite big in some streaming circles is this ability to search a stream, and you can type in a keyword, and somehow it's all been indexed, it's been marked up. I guess very similar in some ways to what Daisy is attempting, and so you can do a search on the stream. For example, you could have this Curtis Chong stream on demand, you could do a search for audio description, and then instantly jump to that particular point in the stream.
Yeah, I know Real has that technology, and I guess you can do Windows Media. Can you get an MP3 jump in a specific location?
Well, with Winamp, they've got HTTP seeking working now, and so that does allow you to jump.
4218 to 4256.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff out there if you want to put the time and the effort into it. And, you know, at some point you got to pay the bills, so you have to.
Ain't that the truth?
Between hobby and career.
Yes. And you've joined the ACB Radio Interactive team these days.
Yes, I've decided to play. I've been wanting to do it for a while, but wanted to make sure I had a fairly reliable connection ability to stream out to San Francisco. And ACB Radio Interactive is a very exciting project. I have a number of different people in so many locations broadcasting live and playing their musical preferences and their ideas about how radio is or how it should be, so. It's exciting.
Yeah, it is. And
if I get a regular shift, I will make a promo and brag about it a little bit and see if we can't get a few listeners.
Very good. I heard that you did your first stint yesterday, which I missed, but I'm sure it was excellent. We certainly are pleased to have you aboard.
Well, I'm pretty excited about it. I want to get back and do some radio and some internet audio, so you may hear my voice around, maybe some product reviews and playing DJ and all that good stuff.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you giving us a call, and do keep in touch.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye now. That's Michael Loft. And, of course, I should mention that Michael's doing a lot of the behind-the-scenes work with these Jim Layton interviews that we get from time to time. I think Jim sends them on some form of media to Mike, and he does all the encoding and things. So we certainly appreciate that. If you're listening to this live on Blindline, it is now 24 minutes to 3 Universal Time, and we'll go to this unknown number caller. Hello there.
Hello, Jonathan.
It's TC. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I just thought I'd check in and thought I'd tell you I uninstalled Pal Talk.
You didn't like it?
Huh?
You didn't like it?
Well, you know, like I was saying, every time I started my computer, it automatically launched it, and I couldn't stop it from doing it, and it comes up with some ad or something like that, and as soon as it would pop up, my speech quit, and I would have to Alt F4 twice to get out of it to get my speech back. And somebody on the NetStream list that I'm on told me, well, he said, as long as you have a software synthesizer and it's a single-channel sound card, you're not going to be able to use programs like that. And he said, of course, you're not missing anything anyway. And I said, I wrote him back on the list, and I said, what's wrong with it? And he said, well, it's not that accessible. He said, or at least it wasn't when I downloaded it. So I just uninstalled it. I mean, it's not really totally gone. It's just in the recycle bin. The folder is in the recycle bin.
I'm interested in this because I do get email from time to time with these packaged invitations to go and have a conversation on PowerTalk, you know. So they're obviously blind people who are using PowerTalk with some degree of success. Maybe one of them can ring up and tell me what the secret is. But yes, the software speech synthesizers with single channel sound cards and trying to do anything, whether it be streaming or some sort of internet voice chatting, there are a myriad of problems you can run into there.
Yeah, it just, I don't know whether it's the ads that pop up every time PowerTalk opens or what it is. Of course, now one time I was able to, I pressed Alt+F4 real quick when I could hear it coming up, because it would, every time it would come up, it would say something like PowerTalk bulletin, and then that was the last thing I heard. But I was able to press Alt+F4 real quick when the computer started grinding, you know, like it does when something's coming up or downloading, and an ad come up there, and I was able to get into the menus and all. But I mean, basically, I didn't like it. I don't like programs that automatically launch every time you connect to the internet. I mean, you know, I don't like programs to do that. I don't want a program to launch until I call it.
Quite right. You keep them under control. You can stop that from happening, of course. You know.
There was an option that said set up, and there was only one option under that. Maybe I didn't alt control tab to the right to. I could maybe press control tab and found another page or something, but I didn't think to do that. I would get so panicked and nervous whenever my speech quit. I still get that way when my speech dies on me.
Yeah, I know the feeling. And what else have you been up to? Because it's been some weeks since we spoke. Did you listen to the convention coverage?
Oh, yes. I haven't been up to doing a whole lot. I've been listening to soap operas, and I'm on a couple of these soap opera message boards on Delphi, and I post a lot there. It's a pity. You know, it's a real shame that some of these soap opera sites that have chat are not accessible, because I mean, you know, I don't even bother when it says chat now or tune into our chat room 24 hours a day. I don't even bother to even try it, because most of these things are just inaccessible, and I've never done text chat, so I'm not even sure if I would even be good at it. But most everything, except for a few things, is mostly, if you get into anything, really, it's just text chat.
So I take it that you are a fan of the audio description, so that you can have all of the juicy bits described in vivid detail on the telly when the soaps are on.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, sometimes, if the person is alone, like when this really bad royal who was trying to take this throne away from his brother and all had his brother's wife in prison and using her as bait, there was a lot of things I couldn't see, and there were a lot of things, you know, going on which my mother hadn't been watching. She would see me, and who would tell me, and, you know, because she would see it. But, you know, sometimes if, you know, like if something's happening or somebody's on a cliff and trying to get up or whatever, you can't tell what's going on if the person is alone, or you can't tell what the person's doing if there's no talking. But anyway, I was kind of fooling around, and since I've been listening to that particular soap opera and this royal, I've been perfecting an accent. And, you know, I don't do it except for my mother. I got where I perfected. I don't really do it for except for my mother, because I would feel kind of silly.
Oh, no. Yeah, you know, that soap opera sounds like the old song about Along Came Jones. You know, the one about, if you don't give me the keys to your ranch, I'll tie you to the railroad track.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, of course, his accent is sort of like this, you know, real formal and proper, his royalty, you know.
Oh.
I think he probably used his regular voice. His regular voice, from what I understand by reading a transcript, is just very ordinary, plain and ordinary, nothing to stand out. Because Mom, she didn't understand why I didn't recognize it when he called this woman, the one he held prisoner for so many weeks in the tower, and
I was going to say, you know, if you had phoned me talking like that, I would probably not have recognized you.
Well, it hurt my pride, really, because I didn't. Because I told Mom, I said, most people, if you've heard their voices long enough, you can detect it if they put on an accent. But he was one of those people who when he put on an accent, it not only changed his accent, it changed his voice.
Yeah.
And not very many, not very many actors can do that. When they put on an accent, you can still, it still sounds like that person with an accent, but when he, which I suppose it was probably his normal voice, he puts on that accent for the role he plays, and it's, I don't know, English or British or something like that. Anyway, he's royalty. He's ex-royalty because he's been dethroned, but anyway, royalty. But
well, but, nice to hear from you, and do keep us posted.
Okay, I sure will.
Okay, cool.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. Yeah. Sorry, I just momentarily speechless. Hello, area code 631.
Hello, Jonathan. You're very low. I can barely hear you.
Oh, dear. Well, I can hear you just fine.
I was just wondering, as far as the text, whatever happened with the smile technology? I thought maybe that would be a way of being able to take care of that problem as far as doing the script with script to text.
Oh, yeah, it's still alive and well. It just requires somebody to type it in. But Smile is what's being used in some implementations of real media streaming, and also it's, I believe, playing a pretty integral part in DAISY technology as well.
Oh, is it really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Jonathan. That was the only thing I really wanted to say. I think as far as the NFP goes, I'm not really too worried about them.
Oh, I see. And are you on Blind Spot tomorrow?
So Marlena tells me. I've been waiting in the wings whenever she says go. So I've been told we're for a go tomorrow. So we will be talking with her tomorrow.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing all of that, and we'll hear from you then.
Alrighty.
Okay, bye now.
Yeah, John.
Bye-bye. Area code 307, hello.
Hey, Jonathan, you may not remember me. This is Donovan Ainsworth.
I remember you. How are you, Donovan?
Well, I'm doing really well. And you know, this is the first time that I've ever called into Blind Line with ACB Radio. I called into Blind Line before, but it was with your other station, MBS-FM.
That's right. I remember you were a huge Queen fan.
Absolutely, and I still am.
Right.
I still am, and they just put out some new stuff, and I'm real very excited about it. And
is that right? What, with Freddie Mercury, or?
Oh, no. There's a new, well, I shouldn't say new, but over in this country, he's fairly new. There's a new British singer that has recently popped on the scene, and his name is Robbie Williams.
Oh, yeah.
He's extremely popular over in Europe. And, matter of fact, he's number one over there, I believe.
Oh, he's huge here as well.
They redid the old Queen classic from 1977, We Are the Champions. And they redid that, and that was for the soundtrack. There was a movie that was recently released, and, of course, the name of the movie escapes me at the moment. I hate that when that happens. But they redid We Are the Champions, and it's absolutely fantastic, and if you get a chance, you ought to check it out.
Home.
And I wanted to ask you, too, by the way, speaking of MBS-FM, what's the status of that station? Because I used to absolutely love that station.
Well, MBS-FM actually now broadcasts to the greater Whanganui area, which is where we are in New Zealand, on 88.5, but we're not doing any more internet at this stage. But it's alive and well and booming out across the city as we speak, 24 hours a day.
So there is no more stream on the MBS-FM website.
No. In fact, as far as I know, there is no MBS-FM website now.
Oh, really? Really? Well, I just want to tell you, but before I get into my comments, excellent job with today's Blind Line. I'm a very frequent listener of ACB Radio. I think the radio station has absolutely done some outstanding, wonderful jobs, and, of course, your coverage of the convention last week was absolutely superb.
Thank you.
I didn't get a chance to hear it live. However, it's all on demand, and I've been enjoying it, and I absolutely just think it's great, and I really appreciate the work you do, and I want to commend you on that.
Well, I appreciate that, and we certainly it all makes it worthwhile when we have people listening and participating.
Well, one of the things I wanted to mention on tonight's interview is I just had a comment, basically, and I just wanted to say that I really feel, because I've known of the American Council and I've known of the NFB for years and years, I used to go to the Nebraska School for the Blind in Nebraska City, And, of course, you know, I've been out of that school for 10 years now. I graduated in 91, and I've been familiar with both organizations for a number of years. And I really feel, I really get the sense that both organizations really do agree on more issues than they disagree. And I really feel strongly that really now, looking at, you know, 2001 versus, you know, maybe 1981 or even 71 or whatever, I feel like that we're actually agreeing more on issues now, on more issues than we ever have.
Interesting you say that. I think that there was a lot of historical baggage which is naturally going to dissipate in its intensity as the leadership changes. And there is a lot going on. I mean, when you look at things like the primacy of Braille, separate state services for the blind, technology issues, there is a lot that's going on which there is agreement. And as I was saying earlier in the program, I suppose it's human nature that we focus on those things where there's contention.
Well, and even, I remember one time, you know, Paul Harvey, which I'm sure you've heard of him, he's probably one of the best newscasters in the world. You know, he spoke at an NFB convention, and I can't remember what year it was. And of course, I wasn't there. I was too young to attend. But even he said that as a general rule, you know, the public tends to focus more on negative news than they do the positive. So I think that certainly plays into what you're saying. The one thing I wanted to mention about this is this brings up an interesting point. When I was attending the School for the Blind back in Nebraska, I can't come out and say, the school supported the ACB or they supported the NFB because, you know, they probably didn't support anybody, although I would have to say that the majority of the staff, if they had to choose, would support the ACB rather than the NFB. What was interesting was, you know, they never talked about the NFB. They never wanted to talk about the NFB. And, you know, whenever I would ask questions about my teachers, you know, I'd say, hey, you know, I've heard of this organization called the NFB, and, you know, of course, back then, you know, they did all these, you know, protest marches with NAC and you know, all these other organizations. And, of course, that was when, you know, Dr. Jernigan was in the leadership, of course, it was in the early 80s. And I'd ask questions, and I'd say, you know, what is it about these guys? Who are these guys? And they'd say, well, you don't want to get involved with them. You don't want to, you know, they're militant. And, you know, they'd never answer my questions. Well, what happened was, is, you know, what they didn't realize was, is, you know, their refusal to answer my questions just fueled the fire for me to want to get curious and to find out more about it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure, it's the forbidden fruit phenomenon.
Huh?
It's like the forbidden fruit phenomenon. If you can't have it and no one tells you about it, it makes you more curious.
Well, yeah. So when I graduated from the school, when I enrolled into the Orientation Center for the Blind in Lincoln, you know, of course, you know, I went to Lincoln, and they actually have a pretty active chapter of the National Federation as well as the council as well. And so I had an opportunity to, you know, to attend meetings from both organizations, and I got a lot of my questions answered. But it was just the idea that, again, you know, when I tried to bring these issues up, you know, they didn't want to talk about them. And I think that, you know, had they been willing to be more open about it and sit down with me and say, well, this is what they do, and this is what the other one does, and you decide, you know, what's right for you, instead of doing that, you know, they just made me more curious, and they just, you know, made me want to find out more just because, you know, they said it was, you know, forbidden or whatever.
Well, yeah, and I hope that in some way ACB Radio has played a part in informing people by giving the perspective that we've been able to through that interview that we played earlier.
Oh, I think it does, and I think ACB Radio has just, it's a phenomenon, really, and I really feel like, you know, this is something that we've needed for a long, long time now, and I feel like ACB Radio has brought people together, and it's not just the issues of the ACB, it's just the fact that, you know, there's, you know, you guys cover all the issues, and I think it's absolutely fair. I think you guys are absolutely fair, and I think your fairness shows when you're willing to have somebody like Curtis Chong from the NFB come on and espouse the views from the other side. And, I you know, if that's not fair, I don't know what is.
Well, I appreciate that, and it's really good to hear from you after a couple of years, and keep in touch. I'm going to play you some Queen to go out with, by the way.
I think you should, and the only other thing I'd like to mention before I leave you tonight, Jonathan, is you were talking about the Smile Files.
Yes.
And I don't know if this has anything to do with anything, you know, you were talking about real media or whatever, but I can tell you that Livestream America, to my knowledge, unless they've changed it, of course they've been making a lot of changes to the sites and updating things, but unless they've changed things, Livestream America does use the Smile file format.
Yes, certainly last I checked they did, yeah.
But that's about all I have, and keep up the great work, and God bless everybody, and God bless you as well.
Thanks, Donovan. Take care.
You have a good evening now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm looking forward to my evening. Well, that's where we're going to wrap it up, I think. I appreciate people phoning in with their perspectives. Let me tell you just before we go that tomorrow there's more stimulating talk radio at ACB Radio Mainstream, and that includes Miller Time with your host Dennis Miller. That will be on at 1 Universal Time on Tuesday. That's Monday evening at 9 Eastern, 6 Pacific. And following that will be Marlena Lieberg back with Blind Spot at 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, 2 Universal Time. And Marlena is speaking with Richard Costa about matters equestrian, as in horsey-type stuff. So make sure you join us for more talk at ACB Radio Mainstream. Appreciate your company. Catch you next week with more Blind Line.
I've paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence but committed no crime. And bad mistakes I've made a few. I've had my share and kicked in my face, but I've come through. I need to go on. We are the champions, my friend, and we'll keep on fighting till the end. We are the champions. We are the champions. No time for losing, 'cause we are the champions of the world. My bows and my curtain calls. You brought me fame and fortune and everything that goes with it. I thank you all, but it's been no bed of roses.